This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Valparaiso Community School Superintendent Rick Fratasha. He'll tell us about the new school that's being built south of US 30. In fact, the ribbon cutting for that is coming up very soon. He'll also bring us up to date as well, too, on an ongoing redistricting plan that is all part of the Valparaiso Community Schools. We'll also hear as well from a noted Indiana economist, writer, and speaker, Morton Marcus. He's had a number of his Eye on the Pie columns come out. We'll talk with him about those. And also on the program today, Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra musical director and conductor Kirk Muspratt. Let's check in on one of the major projects within the Valparaiso Community Schools after the voters and the patrons of the Valparaiso Community Schools approved increases in taxes to cover expenses for referenda. And let's talk with Superintendent Rick Fratasha about these projects, one of which is actually being opened here very soon for the members of the community as well as students to attend. Dr. Fratasha, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you very much, Chris, for the time.
Well, tell us a little bit about, first, I guess, maybe refresh our memories. I mean, for folks who are listening that aren't familiar with the referenda, how things got started, what they were asked, what you'd asked the voters and patrons for, and in turn, what the funds are being used to so far.
Thank you. We went and had two referenda.
Mm-hmm.
One referenda was to upgrade the schools in terms of their infrastructure and obviously the classrooms as well. So we upgraded all of them. And for that, the community let us raise about $160 million. And we began the project in 2015. Now, our first school in completion will be Heavlin Elementary School, south of 30 on Heavlin Road. And we're very excited about it. We're going to do a ribbon cutting on August 13th at 2 o'clock. I'd love to have you there. We've invited our patrons and sent out information about the ribbon cutting. But we have a lot of work going on at the high school that won't be finished until next July. And Cook's Corners and Memorial Elementary Schools are being added on to so you can accommodate more kids with the redistricting. And they'll be completely finished by Christmas, but we're not going to redistrict the kids into the schools that aren't completely finished at the start of school.
Mm-hmm.
So Cook's Corners and Memorial will be finished at Christmas time. The remaining schools are under construction now in terms of renovation, and the rest of the district will be done also next July. So this will be a pretty intense two-and-a-half-year project that our community enabled us to do, and what the community will have is a whole new set of schools at the end of by next July.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing left would be the auditorium and some work in our backfields at the high school.
Yeah. As I recall, when we first talked about this was back at the time when you were explaining to the public the referenda and the reason that the Valparaiso Community Schools was asking for it. You mentioned that it's just a case where the schools at the time were wearing out and they need to be improved, with the exception, of course, of the need for a school south of US 30. And when we remember talking at the time about the fact that the Valparaiso Community Schools had held the property for years. I don't know if it was necessarily, I guess, in the works of having a school built there anytime soon, but you wanted to have the land on hand just in case, and this is obviously that opportunity that's finally come up.
Well, your memory is terrific. I think it was probably four superintendents ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that Mr. Phillips, who was the superintendent at the time, 40 years ago, believed that one of the areas that Valparaiso was going to grow in the future was south of 30. And so he purchased the land that we built the school on. And so 40 years ago, the land was purchased with his vision, and it's served us well. It saved us a lot of, obviously, we didn't have to buy as much land, And so that saved us considerable amount of money in the referendum.
Now, in retrospect, do you think that maybe that he was a bit of a visionary, or did he know in talking with people that there would be an idea that someday that there would be such expansion south of U.S. 30? It just at the time, nobody seemed to think of it.
You know, I think in all seriousness, Valpo as a city and school corporation has been blessed with folks that look to the future and see what's Valpo going to look like and need in the future. And I think he is one of those folks. I never really met him. Mm-hmm. I've heard interesting things about him. His love for Valpo and his knowledge of the area. And that would be an interesting mix, because at the time, 40 years ago, I mean, that's 1977. I came to Valpo in 1987. So he had made those purchases when Valpo wasn't nearly as developed as it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what people think of the new school. What kind of reaction have you gotten from the public as the school was being constructed, and especially people that live on that side of the highway, seeing a new school go up in their neighborhood, so to speak?
Yeah, great question. Well, typically you get a lot of interest at first, a little bit of nervousness about mm-hmm. how the school is going to impact the area in terms of traffic, kids running around, and that sort of thing. Then when the school begins to take shape and becomes more real, and they see that, it's not just, you haven't just put a rectangular brick building in their backyard, and you build it so you can invite the kids back to school after school and on weekends, we've gotten really, really terrific response. The area, given its geographic location, asked if we could build an oversized gym instead of an elementary gym, so that we can provide those services for a wider area. And it is going to probably be our biggest, our most populated school. Mm-hmm. So we redesigned our initial design, obviously, and put in a larger gym that they requested. Also, we put in emergency utilities in the event that we have an ice storm like we had, 10, 12 years ago, mm-hmm. that if the community can find its way to the school, it'll be able to be heated and they'll be more safe.
And that makes an idea. Do you think about that? I know that you have to make these changes, I guess, kind of piecemeal as you try to make these improvements in the schools to take care of these emergencies that come up like that. You see, like you say, that it's been, 10 years since the last bad ice storm that caused problems. But if you have other bad weather incidents like what have come up off and on, that you want to be sure that you're prepared for those. And if anything, that you have to kind of retrofit the school for these. But it's nice to be able to plan this out right at the outset, I'm sure.
And, you know, and as a result of that sort of thinking, we did the same thing that three other schools strategically placed in the school corporation, so that the townsfolk can get to those gymnasiums and cafeterias to warm up or cool off. Both middle schools have that emergency, and so does the high school. Mm-hmm. So with those four, we think we can take care of an awful lot of the community in an emergency.
We're talking with Dr. Rick Fatasha, who is the superintendent of the Valparaiso Community Schools. They're continuing the work on improving schools in the district, and the big improvement, of course, is a brand new school, Heavlin Elementary School, that is going up south of U.S. 30 on Heavlin Road. The ribbon cutting, by the way, is going to be on Sunday, August 13th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you are invited as the member of a public. And of course, it'll open to stores officially for the students the following day, the first day of the 2017-2018 school year, which is August 14th. Dr. Fatasha, one thing that I know that was noted and I wanted to cover in our conversation today, and you kind of alluded to it here, is the redistricting plan. This was a project that was started, about a year and a half ago or maybe longer, that is a very long-ranging project to deal with the entire school district. Please tell us about that.
Yes, I started it, you're right, it's about 18 months ago, mm-hmm. and we walked it through the board and the community several times. And obviously the initial plan was changed considerably based on public input, and frankly, the public's input into the plan really made it better. So in putting the plan together and then we'll operationalize it next school year, not this school year, it'd be mm-hmm. next school year. Obviously, we'll operationalize the Heavland redistricting this year, but the rest of the school district will be redistricted next year. And we communicated to parents this year where they were going to be going next year. So in the event that we have openings in schools that they're going to be going to, they can seek an intra-district transfer to get ahead of the game. But it's a rigorous process. It's very, very difficult at first. Mm-hmm. Because it shocks people that you have a percentage of folks leaving what they consider to be their home school, and it is their home school, and they're going to another school. And on the one hand, it's tiring when folks are upset with you. On the other hand, it's a good thing. It's a nice thing that they're upset with you because they love the school. And so, it's a sword with two fine edges, and as a superintendent, you just figure I'd rather have them mad at me because they love their school.
Well, that's true. That's probably better that way, I suppose. Now, the way this setup now you mentioned that the real changes won't take place until the 2018-2019 school year. Is there anything besides Heavland Elementary School, which is going to be opened up and in the mix now for this coming school year? Is there anything else that the public will know about, or will they see anything within this upcoming school year that will lead them to remind them about the changes coming ahead?
Well, I think the whole face, the eastern face of the high school, mm-hmm. Along Campbell, I mean, right now, obviously, when you drive by the high school, you know there's a great deal of construction going on. But as they begin to button up and come to more completion with the eastern front, I think the public will get a more distinct picture of the work that's going on in the high school, because mm-hmm. it's really going to be a beautiful front.
That's great. I was going to ask a time in the future, but I figure this is a great opportunity to bring the topic up here. You're obviously getting ready for another school year. You're just a matter of weeks away now from the start of the 2017-2018 school year. As the school district moves ahead, are you ready, do you think, in light of all the problems that you face in finances from the fact that the state of Indiana basically controls most of public school finances these days, are you ready to be able to go into the school year? Do you feel more comfortable financially than maybe you have been?
We're in pretty good shape financially. Mm-hmm. I'm not happy with the funding. But we'll figure it out. I mean, we have no choice.
Yeah.
We have to come to some kind of conclusion about how this funding mechanism works, because it almost feels like a roll the dice what's going to happen every year. Mm-hmm. Thus far, we've got estimates from 0.5% to 0.9%. And in all seriousness, if you don't do anything in the school business, there'll be an increase in costs or expenditures. Utilities go up. We don't have a control over that. Insurance goes up. We don't have a control over that. And so those things tend to eat up a lot of the new money that you get. Mm-hmm. But we've been really fortunate. Our teachers have been terrific. Our administrators have been terrific. Our community has been terrific, just holding, and understanding that 0.9% of 1% is you have to have some sacrifices there.
Yeah, that's true. Now, do you think, in working with your colleagues that are members of the state superintendents group, as well as the Indiana State School Boards Association that represents the school board as well, do you think that you'll all go back to your lawmakers here in Northwest Indiana and lobby with others as well, too, at the State House in this upcoming legislative session, this coming January, to ask them to take another look at the funding situation?
I'm certain we will. Because we've been asking for it for years. And frankly, there are legislators that ask for it as well, that they have a lot of questions about the formula. And it's very difficult in the public sector to say that you really do need a funding source that's more steady in order to vision the future more accurately and to take care of your kids. But like I said, we've gotten used to being able to look across the table or look at the folks and say, it's going to be pretty tight this year. Thanks for helping.
Mm-hmm.
And they have.
That's great. That's
they
great.
Have.
Well, Dr. Fattasia, I'm looking forward to the big ribbon cutting ceremony coming up at Heavenland Elementary School on Sunday, August 13th in the afternoon. And of course, the start of the new school year right after that. And I thank you very much for spending some time with us to talk not only about the new school on Heavenland Road south of US 30 and all the other work that's happening in the other elementary schools and intermediate and in the high school there in Valparaiso, but look perhaps to the future as well, too. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Valparaiso Community School Superintendent Rick Fattasia. And we appreciate you spending time with us to talk on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Mr. Nolte. I appreciate it.
Economic rebirth in Indiana downtowns can be a two-way street, literally. Hoosier cities are spending millions of dollars to convert one-way main streets into two-way arteries. The change can help boost the local economy, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek tells us it can also be hard on small businesses.
John von Erdmannsdorf is a West Lafayette institution. Locals just call him John Von. He's spent almost 50 years selling all kinds of treasures out of his row of stores, Von's Shops, on State Street. It runs straight through Purdue University, meaning summer is usually a little slow. But nothing like this year, the year of State Street road construction.
It's awful when you go outside and you look in your parking lot that's often you're worried about, are there enough room for people? And there's nobody out there but your employees.
Von's Shops are boxed in as the city converts State Street from one- to two-way traffic. They've torn up pavement, fenced off most sidewalks, and restricted driving access for Von's to an alley. John Von says it's cut even their lower summer revenue in half, forcing him to lay off a third of his employees.
I mean, we are going in the red every day, and we hope we can get through another 7 weeks of this.
West Lafayette broke ground on the $120 million State Street project right after graduation, and they're racing to finish it by mid-August when Purdue students return. It's an approach many Indiana downtowns take when modernizing their main streets. One of the latest to finish doing that is South Bend, where Pete Buttigieg is mayor.
If you do all at once and have a lot of disruption but get it over with quickly, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid and you're better off in the end.
Buttigieg says South Bend did its best to communicate during construction. The city ran a website with live updates on detours and kept in touch with business owners about their access needs. The whole project cost $25 million, but Buttigieg says it's helped bring in $90 million in downtown housing, hotel, and retail investments.
This is fundamentally not a traffic project, it's an economic development project, and that's what made it worth the investment. That's what makes it worth accepting a couple minutes slowdown in your commute.
All right, what is so great about two-way streets? I put that question to Eric Carlson, the development director in West Lafayette. We meet at the intersection of State Street, or what's left of it, and a cross street that became two-way at the start of the project. Here's why Carlson says the community needs it.
One-way streets make cities pass-throughs when they really should be destinations.
He says the one-way pattern is a relic of suburbanization. These days, he says, streets are about more than just moving cars quickly. They're about bikes and people and commerce. Carlson says West Lafayette's narrower two-way State Street will also have a lower speed limit.
You want to stay there. You want to do business there, you know, which is go buy something from a shop, go have a drink on the sidewalk, and enjoy your surroundings. And one-way streets don't allow you to do that by and large.
But for now, State Street is not very welcoming. Noisy bulldozers kick up dust as they prepare the road for new pavement. The chain-link fences on the sidewalks bear signs with little dancing pedestrian figures saying, "Keep going," to people heading for partially blocked stores. Carlson says he knows it's not an ideal way to do business.
It looks like a mess right now. It's a series of controlled chaos, but it's something we know here in the next few months, we're going to have a real gem in the middle of West Lafayette, and we want people to come enjoy it and see why we've been doing all of this work.
Carlson attributes about $300 million in pending downtown investment, at least in part, to the State Street project. That means property values and taxes are going up in the area, too. Back at Vaughn's shops, John Vaughn says he'll cross that bridge when he comes to it. He's more anxious for an actual bridge, the temporary one workers will build to his store in a couple of weeks after they pave the new State Street and start in on the sidewalks.
I just keep hoping that when the chain link fence comes down, it will be more appealing for the pedestrian traffic. And if the people out there listening know that they can still drive here, maybe they will come back too.
After half a century on State Street, he hopes his business can endure just a little longer. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in West Lafayette.
I have an update on this West Lafayette situation for you. The deadline to reopen State Street from University Street to Salisbury Street, there in the, what's called the Village, is August 13th. It's one day before thousands of new Purdue University students will be moving into the residence halls. The next phase of construction starts August 14th. We'll have State Street open from University Street to the east down to the Wabash River Bridge, although with some restrictions in place with that. And with the deadline just weeks away, construction crews are kicking in into high gear. In fact, last week they started working on Sundays, and they may actually have to start doing overnight shifts very soon. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time to check in with noted Indiana economist, author, and speaker, Morton Marcus. Morton is on the road this time, and he's in Massachusetts. Morton, thank you for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Now let's talk about some of your columns that, that have come out here lately, the Eye on the Pie columns we are referring to. First, let's look into some of the ones that you had back in June, one in particular, which is entitled The Cost of Living in Indiana. I thought we've kind of figured out how much it costs to live here in the Hoosier State.
Well, the issue that I was trying to focus on is that employers so often say to workers, well, we may pay you less, but the cost of living in Indiana is low, so that's it's not really hurting you. Mm-hmm. You know, think of what it would be like to be living in San Francisco or Boston or Chicago even. So we have a tendency to have low pay because so many people believe the cost of living is low. Well, the real issue is that the cost of living is low is because the wages are low. If you've got the money, you will pay more for housing because you're willing to pay more for housing. You're willing to buy better housing, and the market will respond by building better housing. And yes, that becomes more expensive, but that's because you've got the money for it. It's the same way with groceries and other items. The cost of lettuce is about the same everywhere, but the availability of quality food items is not the same everywhere. We now have over there on the west side of the county, we have Whole Foods. Well, Whole Foods has finally come to Lake County. Why is that? It's because they've finally gotten around to recognizing that there's enough money in Lake County in nearby Illinois to support one of their stores. Many people complain that they have to go into Chicago to buy some of the things they want, particularly the high-income people. Well, we just don't have a lot of high-income people in Lake County or Porter County compared to other places. It's the fact that wages are low, salaries are low in Indiana, and then you have to ask the question, why is that? And the answer to that, I think, is that the things that we make, the things that we do, are highly competitive in the world. We don't have a lot of unique things. When you talk about New York, they have the financial center. They have Wall Street. When you talk about Chicago, they're a transportation hub. They're the greatest transportation hub in the United States. You talk about Los Angeles, and they've got the entertainment industry. These are distinctive things. What do we make in Lake and Porter counties? We make things where there is a lot of competition.
One of the other columns that you had out here recently talks about, you're talking, they mentioned about the fact that about the cost of living, and turn it fits in, of course, with because of our cost of living is lower, but we are also getting paid less. And you note that there are some counties in Indiana, maybe not necessarily in Northwest Indiana, but certainly in the rest of the Hoosier State, that aren't getting, on the average, paid very much.
That's right. We have many counties where the products that they produce just aren't highly valued by the marketplace, where there's a lot of competition, where people don't have the education to attract the employers who want to or can pay higher wages. If you've got a county that's loaded with people who have no computer experience because they have very poor internet service, if they have any internet service, then their kids aren't learning about the internet. They're not learning to use computers. They don't have computers in the schools, and they just continue a cycle of low income.
One of the other areas I've noted here, and going along with what you said here, and I've seen recently, and you probably have too, some announcements from some of the rural Southwest Indiana counties saying that we're beefing up to help bring in more economic development into our communities and counties in particular. A rural county, to be sure, Davis County, which is home to a lot of small towns like Odin and other places like that. They're in the area that's not far from Jasper, but they're just the same. They're out there in I guess, the middle of the great part of the Hoosier State, the quiet wooded part in many places, a lot of farms around, but not many factories.
Well, Davies County, particularly Washington, Indiana, which is the county seat, has been doing a good job over many years in terms of being able to bring in one factory that may produce something, I forget exactly what mm-hmm. it is, but the byproducts of that factory are then used by a factory that's next door. And it goes on the same way. The second factory produces something that can be used by the third factory. And so you get a complex that are using each other's products and makes that county very attractive. The other thing is I-69 goes right outside Washington, Indiana, and US 50 is four-laned over to Vincennes, which gives you access then north and south, not only to Evansville, but all the way up into northwest Indiana and mm-hmm. into the Chicago area.
Well, that sounds, this is really a perfect example of what county should be doing, like in the case here of Davis County and the city of Washington in particular. You mentioned having this multiple series of factories that all depend on each other for some kind of feedstock, and the product of which or the waste of which is being used by another. It works out very well. So we should see more counties look very closely at this.
That's one way of doing it. But at the same time, there's a great deal of controversy in Davies County mm-hmm. Over the Economic Development Corporation and its lack of transparency. There are people who don't want to see Davies County grow so fast, and what they see is the congestion of a small town because there's more traffic, and cities don't build new streets. That's one of the problems that we get. So we get more congestion as we get more economic development, and many people in any community of any size want the place to stay as it is, or even go back to what it was.
We're talking with Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus and some of the Eye on the Pie columns that he's put out recently. Morton, another column here talks a little bit about, the headline to it says, Government Aid to Individuals. Tell us about that, where the idea for that column came from.
Well, we all know that the federal government provides a tremendous amount of money to people. Social Security is the greatest example of that. Now, there are people who believe that Social Security is sort of like a bank account. You put your money in and then you take it out. The truth is that most people get Social Security payments far in excess of what they've put in. That's something that helps older people keep up with changes in prices. Lately, the increases in Social Security have been very limited because we've had very little inflation. But basically, it's gives a floor of income to people. And we have to remember that a large, large number of people do almost no savings for their retirement, and that companies are cutting back on their pension programs. In fact, some companies have cut out having any kind of pension. What they do is they encourage their employees to put money into the stock market in a 401k program or something like that. Well, that's a very risky kind of thing to do. The stock market has a good record, but it's highly volatile at times also. And when you need the money, the stock market can be down. Mm-hmm. You have to hope for long-term gains, which means you have to hope for more productivity in the labor force. The other thing is we have Medicare and we have Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid are basically payments for medical services, which means the money doesn't go to the people who are getting the benefit of it. The money actually is going to the medical profession, the healthcare providers. And it makes it possible for the healthcare providers to raise their billings because they know the government's going to pick that up. That's one of the central issues that we've got right now with this whole healthcare debate, is how do we cut the prices, the amount of money that's going to our doctors, that's going to our hospitals. Nobody wants to say that that's really where the problem is that we're spending a lot of money. We talk about the costs of healthcare, but we don't tell, you know, who's doing the billing to Medicare and Medicaid, who are the ones who are actually getting the money. It is a great service to the individual. But it's also a tremendous amount of subsidy to the whole healthcare industry and the insurance industry. Mm-hmm.
A related topic that you have in another column coming up that has come out here in July talks about being alone and aging and if it's a problem for Indiana. That's an interesting column. You kind of take it with the interesting allegory with one of the characters that you often mention in the columns here to get people's attention. This gentleman who calls himself or is called by his friends the Duke of Dinwiddie. We know where Dinwiddie is, and obviously you do too, of course. But the interesting thing you talk about being alone and getting older, and how does this all fit in together with what you usually talk about?
Well, we just don't realize that when we drive down the street and we see a house, we sort of assume that it's a family that lives there, and that there's mom and dad and two kids. That's not what America is. America has, I think the figure is about 27% of all the housing that we have, all the households that we have one person in them. Now, that person may be a young person, and more because of the baby boom, we're finding that these people are older people. And a person who lives alone, whether they're young or old, has safety problems, you know, just falling in the house. You know, when we think of falling in the house, we think, well, that's naturally a problem of an older person. Yes, it's more frequent with older people, but it's a danger to anyone who's living alone. We have all kinds of economic consequences. People living alone will buy a refrigerator. They may have a washing machine. The number of the size of your refrigerator is rarely an indication of the number of people living in the household. It isn't true that people living alone are going to have a smaller refrigerator than a family of four. Mm-hmm. So there's an economic aspect to this. Households as an economic entity are different from families. And when one quarter of all households are single-person households, in effect, it's more expensive for them to buy that refrigerator because there's one income. Many families have two incomes and in fact have more money. And there's a lack of recognition in our society that we have large numbers of people who live alone. I'm not saying they're necessarily lonely, but mm-hmm. I'm saying that they are living alone and that there are consequences for living alone.
Well, Morton, these are interesting comments here and interesting things to think about here. We've been talking with Indiana economist, speaker and writer Morton Marcus about some of his Eye on the Pie columns. We've got some others we'll pick up here. We'll have another conversation very soon. Morton, thank you for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Another season for the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra is coming up. I talked on Friday with the musical director and conductor of the orchestra, Kirk Muspratt, about it and more. The summer concert series pretty much coming to a close here. What do we have to look forward to in the months ahead?
Well, this is our 76th season of the orchestra, Chris. And actually, for our Pops concert, it really will be the very last year now.
That's right. We'll talk about that here in a moment.
Yeah, it will be. So we're going to open our concerts with a Brass Transit, which is the only cover band in the world that's licensed to do the music of Chicago. So they have all the brass players, all the great singers, and all the wonderful, wonderful classic rock tunes of Chicago, and we're going to do that at our opening concert on the 16th of September. In October, we're going to play the Mikado with a full chorus, a full cast, some costumes, some super titles, and of course, the Mikado is the enormous Gilbert and Sullivan farce that is truly about British politics, all hidden within a Japanese love silly story. Yeah.
Well, okay, it's not much of a love story, but it'll do. It's more about Japanese, more about British politics, but that's all
it
right.
Is.
That's,
yeah.
But that's what makes it so much fun, and that's why it's such an endearing Gilbert and Sullivan classic, to be sure.
It is, yes.
Now, coming up here as we go into the fall months here, we get, of course, get closer to the end of the year as well, too. What's ahead?
In December, on December 7th, we will have our very last concert at the Star Theater, and it happens to be the 76th birthday that night of the orchestra. We have a full chorus again, wonderful guest artists, and we have the kids from Hobart Strings and the young artists from Crown Point High Chorus with us. Santa will be there. Last year we sold the concert out, so I hope you'll get your tickets early.
That's great. That's great. Now, we'll talk here a little bit here about the future, but we know that, of course, there's one more concert after the winter concert, one that looks at Valentine's Day. Let's talk about that.
There's actually three concerts left.
Oh, okay, good.
So just before Valentine's Day on February 9th, we have two huge, beautiful, romantic pieces. The last piano concerto of Beethoven, nicknamed the Emperor, and we have the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony, which is one of the top 20 most beloved orchestral pieces and super romantico.
That's great.
Then, March the 16th, at Bethel, we're going to do a classical concert of the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with my friend J. Laurie Bloom from the Chicago Symphony playing the clarinet. It's one of the last pieces that Mozart ever wrote, and one of the very first clarinet concerti. So that's interesting. I think we're going to close with Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty and Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, which are orchestral blockbuster, again, very romantic, beautiful pieces. And in between that, we're going to do a tango mass. I know that sounds sort of counterintuitive, but it's a wonderful thing. It's a mass, but it's all written in the style of Argentinian tango.
Oh.
And it's written by Bakalov, the fantastic Italian composer who wrote, you know, film music like, for instance, like Il Postino.
Mm-hmm. Unless you happen to be familiar with Argentine music, you probably never heard this before, so that'll be something to look forward to.
It's very cool with the Argentinian bandoneon, which is like the Argentinian tango accordion. It's really a cool piece.
That's great. Now, I wanted to wrap up our conversation here, talking a little bit here about what to look ahead here, as you mentioned earlier, the fact that this last Christmas concert is coming up at the Star Plaza Theater before the Star Plaza is closed and taken down. Oh, any plans that that you had had a chance to work with John Kane as far as the symphony is concerned, and looking for a bigger venue to be able to do the big things. Now, of course, Bethel Church does a great job with a lot of the concerts, but you still have to look for a really big place. And are you working on that?
I leave that to the management and the folks who do that. I know that at this point, we will absolutely do the last Pops concert of the year. Mm-hmm. We just won't have the Star Theater. It'll be dust by then. So around May 11th and 12th on that weekend, it's not confirmed yet where we will do those concerts, but it will be Showboat and Show Tunes, and it's a Lawrence and Hart, fantastic, amazing, gorgeous music from their musicals. And then we will do the whole second half will be Showboat. Mm-hmm. But I can't exactly tell you as we tape today, Chris.
Yeah.
I can't exactly tell you for sure.
So stay tuned. We'll have more on that later, Kirk.
Yes.
Musbrad, thank you very much for the update on the great symphonies. You can always check out on the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra's website and get your tickets there too, or you can call the box office over in Munster, but go on the website and check things out in particular, and stay in touch on the website to find out more about the venues for all of the concerts coming up in the next season.
Thank you very much, Chris.
And on this Monday, here's another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Wendy Marciniak, who is executive director, right?
I am, yes.
With the Chesterton Arts Center. And you've been in that position for about, 3 years now?
Close to three, 2.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to be accurate as possible. And, of course, your big activity, you have year-round activities,
we
obviously.
Do.
And you've been there forever. The Chesterton Art Fair has been around for a long time. But the big activity is the Summer Art Fair.
Correct.
Chesterton Art Fair, famous.
Yes, this is our 59th year. So next year it'll be our 60th, and we're already starting to plan some special things mm-hmm. for that. But last year we moved the fair. It was our first year at Dogwood Park in mm-hmm. Chesterton, mm-hmm. and that turned out to be a really, really good move, mm-hmm. Not only for the artists, but also for the patrons who came to the fair. Due to the fact that there was more parking and flat ground mm-hmm. and more room for food vendors and other fun activities, music and children's art experiences. And so we're really looking forward to going back this year.
Good. And my boyhood friend, Joel Janowski, is your board president,
isn't he? He is, yes. And he is very handy being a surveyor in laying out that fair. So that is a win-win.
He told me about that.
Yes, yes. Joel's a great guy and a great board president. So
good.
We're really happy to have him.
Good. I'm glad that's he's sort of emerged as a really wonderful arts volunteer and booster. And
yes, and he is also quite an accomplished watercolorist, too. So he likes to paint and sketch and draw. Mm-hmm. So, yes, he's the total package.
That's fantastic. Well, so what are the dates of this year's show?
This year's fair are Saturday, August 5th and Sunday, August 6th. And we are already praying for perfect weather like we had last year.
Yeah. And you have I'm always interested in what the food's going to be.
Okay. Well, we have several local vendors. Ivy's Bohemia House has wonderful eclectic food and wraps, and they'll be there again this year. We have a couple civic organizations that provide walking tacos and hot dogs and that kind of thing. And also Redimax will be there with
really?
Their food truck. Yes.
Ooh.
They were there last year and sold out by 2:30 on Saturday, so they're bringing an extra truck this year.
Goodness.
And you know, they're pretty famous for what they do.
Yeah.
And of course there'll be ice cream and goodies, and everybody needs something sweet at about 3 o'clock, so
and how
be
many
plenty.
Artists do you can participate?
This year, I think we will have around 90,
yeah.
and they come from all over the country, and it's a juried fair, so mm-hmm. you're getting the cream of the crop
yeah.
and in all media, and so we're really excited.
Well, beyond the art fair, what are some of your upcoming gallery shows?
Let's see. In August, we will be hosting the Ileana Artists Show, and that is also a juried show. And we kind of flip-flop with them every other year. And this is their year, and it's for artists in Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And then in actually, the Ileana Artist Show is in September.
Okay.
in August, we will be hosting 18 artists. Mm-hmm. And that group evolved from members of the Chesterton Arts Center mm-hmm. years ago.
So I remember when they had their little standalone gallery.
They did, yes, for many years. Mm-hmm. Now they do a lot of online shows and regional outlets they visit, and they'll be with us in August. Mm-hmm. And then in September, we'll host the Ileana Arts Show.
I would imagine the membership of the 18 artists has ebbed and flowed over the years somewhat.
It's never quite 18. Sometimes it goes above and sometimes below, but I think right now they're above. So.
It's nice they can be flexible.
That's right. That's right.
That's good. And what's coming up? What is this Art After Dark Gala?
Oh, that's really fun. This will be our ninth year, Friday, November 3rd. And it's held at Sand Creek Country Club in Chesterton. And it's just a really fun night of art. We have silent auction items from artists that are regional and local. And there's fabulous dinner, of course, mm-hmm. at Sand Creek, mm-hmm. and dancing. And we usually have some entertainment. And it's just really a fun night to appreciate the arts.
And is Rita Berg still involved with
Rita
that?
Rita Berg is very involved. She is, again, our chairman for this uh-huh. lovely affair. And she has many volunteers that help out as well. And it's really supported by the community very well. There's always a lot of really, really nice silent auction items uh-huh. to bid on. And it's sort of a night for patrons of the arts to come out and really help support us. And the monies that are raised from both the art fair and the Art After Dark Gala help us run the Art Center for the coming year mm-hmm. and especially some of our programming.
Good. Well, Wendy, good luck with everything. You have a lot on your plate, and this all sounds good.
It is. Every day is fun over there. So,
well, thank you for being here to tell us about it, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's Eye on the Arts host John Kane talking with Wendy Marciniak of the Chesterton Art Fair about the upcoming 59th annual summer event. You can hear this conversation and the previous Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, LakeshorePublicRadio.org. And tune in next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. On tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with Heather Ennis from the Northwest Indiana Forum. She joined in with a number of other people from Indiana to a visit to the Northwest, that is to say, Seattle, to check out economic news there. And Ball State University economist Michael Hicks will join us with more information about a new report that's out from the Center for Business Economics and Research. That's coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.